Let's open our Bibles to Isaiah chapter 40 this morning. Isaiah chapter 40. As we sung that first song today, that first hymn, the third verse of the hymn is applicable to the sermon today. Listen to these words again that you just sung. Oh, to grace, how great a debtor, daily I'm constrained to be. Let thy goodness like a fetter, like a chain, let thy goodness like a chain bind my wandering heart to thee, prone to wander. Anybody relate? Anybody relate to being prone to wander from the goodness and the love of God, and we want to do our own thing? He goes on, prone to wander, Lord, I feel it, prone to leave the God I love. In other words, Robert Robinson, writing that hymn, was saying honestly and forthrightly, I struggle all the time to not do what I know is right, and not to do what I know I need to do. Paul says some of the similar things, didn't he? Prone to leave the God I love. Here's the next part of the song. Here's my heart, O take and seal it. In other words, he's saying, God, here's my heart. The heart that's prone to wander. Take and seal it for thy courts above. Seal it, use it, make me usable. I every day I'm prone to go over here. God, I want my heart to be under your control. Above all else. That's the title of the message. Robert Robinson was saying, above all else, I want my heart to not wander anymore. Yet it still wants to. And I want you, God, to take my life and use it. Above all else, God. Name above all names. God. Above all gods. God, creator above all of his creation. So I want to ask you a question at the beginning of the message, and I'll end the message with the same question. Does God have your heart? Does God, who's above all else, we'd all say that, he's the creator above his creation, he's the God above all gods, the name above all names, you could fill in the blank with whatever description you want to say about God, and hopefully it would be true, and we'd say that's our desire, but yet we're prone to wander, right? So does God have your heart? Is he truly above all else in all the areas of your life? Whatever you make more important than God is an idol. Whatever you make more important in your life, you know that area that's prone to wander, becomes more important than God. In Isaiah's day, God had been, Jehovah, had been for the most part replaced and at times reduced to idol worship. For many of the Jews, they had succumbed to the deceptive power and they worshiped false gods, just like their soon-to-be captors, the Babylonians. The Jewish people were spiritually depraved. They had become immoral. They had become idolaters. You want to talk about a group of people who were prone to wander? It was them. At this point in our study in Isaiah 40, God has commanded Isaiah to comfort. Remember in chapter 40? Comfort my people, because the Jews were going to soon be captive in heathen Babylon. He wanted to give an encouraging word that it's not how the history would end for the nation. It wasn't going to end in captivity. Something better was going to come to the people of God. To Israel, enslaved in Babylon and snarled by idolatry, these were lofty promises. And the question that many would have asked is, could they be kept? Would God keep his word? Could the Lord return in glory, as he said in verse 5? Could Israel be delivered? in the midst of the might and glory of Babylon. Isaiah has painted a picture in chapter 40 of God. And it's a picture that honestly can only lead to one conclusion. He's above all else. Who can hold the water? All the waters in the hollow of his hand. Who can face the nations and say they're just a drop in the bucket? Who can say, my word will be fulfilled? Who but God? He's truly above all else. And that's the picture that Isaiah has given in this chapter. He has given the conclusion that Jehovah is the true God and there is no one else like him. His work will be done and his work will be completed. Isaiah has declared in chapter 40, in this mountaintop of a chapter, he has declared God's power, God's wisdom, God's sovereignty over all the nations of the world. Verses 12 and 17 support this claim. All nations before him are as nothing. Verse 17, they are counted to him less than nothing. That's an intensification of nothing. They're less than nothing, and they are vanity. Doesn't mean the nations are not worth something. People are worth something. But to God, compared to his power and his greatness and his glory and his sovereignty, the nations are just nothing. To a spiritually starved people, the people of Judah, held captive in a faraway land from their city of Jerusalem, from their temple, which will be destroyed in just a few years from this passage, could it be possible that a stronger Babylon could be overcome by these Jews? That would be the question that perhaps the remnant might have on their minds. It appeared physically and spiritually. The Babylonians and their gods were stronger than Jews and their God. That's what it probably appeared to many of these people. The people themselves blamed what they thought was a powerless God, instead of blaming their own sin of idolatry for their condition. And instead of their own ancestors and their own depravity, God's chosen people had fallen to the age-old lie where they believed that the false idols of man's hands were responsible for their failures, when in reality, it was their belief in the idols that was responsible for their failures. So today, as we open your notes, in your sermon notes in front of you, I wrote, Isaiah now is prophetically reminding them, that is the people of Judah, this most important truth. There is no God like Jehovah. There is no comparison of false gods to Jehovah. God will not accept God plus another God. God will not be replaced or added to. He will validate that his strength is unmatched, his greatness is incomparable, and his sovereignty, while challenged, will not be altered. And that's where we are in this chapter today, here in chapter 40. Look at verse 18. Look at the questions that Isaiah now asks as a result of showing that God is this great God. It says, to whom then will you, Judah, liken God? Or what likeness or image will you compare unto him? In other words, there's a natural conclusion that Isaiah asks as he is given this huge and unbelievable picture of the transcendent, glorious God and all of his power and might and sovereignty. He says, so who can be like God? Judah, who are you going to liken to God? Who can stand next to God and say, I'm equal? What likeness, what image that you worship in your homes is like this God? Can God, who is spirit, friends, who is spirit, be likened to his creation? In other words, how can we make an idol that pictures God, who is a spirit? Can God be compared to an image made with man's hands? Well, you might be a good craftsman. And there might be the best of the best craftsmen that can make the greatest, cool, awesome-looking idols, so to speak, right? But does that really compare to who God is? That's the questions Isaiah is asking of these people. And the answer is only one answer. There's only one right answer. There is no one or nothing that can compare to God. Nothing can be compared to God because he is the creator. And all that he has made is his creation. It is the very work of his hands. Meanwhile, remember what Isaiah said in this chapter? Remember what he said? Man is finite. Man is limited. Man is bound by time. Man has been created. Man is, here you go, man's temporal. And every week we witness or we hear of people we know that have passed away. Life is temporal. God is infinite. God is loving. God is limited only by his own will. God is eternal. God is the creator. His attributes and his character traits are unchangeable. The comparison between man and God spans a gap so wide that our minds cannot even begin to conceive the difference. And Isaiah's tried. But even then, we can't really conceive that God could hold all the water in the hall of his hand. He tries to give us an illustration that our minds could grasp. And in reality, I can't grasp that. How could all of Weiser Lake and Bellingham Bay be in the hollow of God's hand? I mean, let alone the Pacific Ocean and Atlantic, and you add them all up. We must always remember this truth or we will quickly fall into the trap of idolatry, thinking that man and God are similar. We've got to remember that this comparison is God is transcendent. He is above all. We are just created beings under his hand. And if we stop, if we start to go down this path, we get just like Robert Robinson. We start to wander. We're prone to wander. Oh, you say, I believe all that he's saying here. Yeah. Yeah, until tomorrow, when you start wandering again, right? These Jews had added to God. Oh, they said they would worship Jehovah, but then they were worshiping their idols. While what we are going to talk today for the next few minutes is relevant to the Jews, all that is in this chapter is of importance to mankind, including us in the church today. And I know it's not written for the church, but the application is clear for us today. God cannot be brought to the level of his creation. Did you hear that? God cannot be brought to the level of his creation. But when we try to craft an idol, that's what we're doing. When those who are making idols try to build something that is representative of God, or they do point to the sun, or whatever it is that has been made by God, that's what they are doing. They're trying to bring God to the level of his creation. You know what Isaiah is saying? Stop. God is above all. He's above all else. While man is made in God's image, and that's what Genesis tells us, and that in that sense, he is like God. Although we're not divine, I'm not saying that, but man has been made in God's image. Isaiah is saying to regulate God and to compare him to man is laughable at best and idolatry at worst. But that's what the Jews were doing. They were trying to take God and make him into a man-made creation. So let me ask you again, to whom will you liken God today? What likeness will you compare with him? Friends, you say, Pastor Randy, well, we don't have any idols on our mantle. Oh, yes, you do. Idols are everywhere in America. They're everywhere in America, and they are in your home. They are in my home. They don't look like little wood things, and they may not look like gold things or wood, iron things or brass things. But they look like paper green dollars. And they look like our children. And they look like our possessions. They're everywhere. And if there was an idolatrous nation in the world, there may not be one worse than the United States of America. So don't come today thinking, well, this is for those people. Because they only, what we're going to read about the goldsmith making the gold over the idol and the wood and all of what we're going to speak for the next few minutes, oh, that was just for them. Friends, idols are just as apparent in my house and your house as they were in those houses. They just look a little different. Let's look today at several principles based upon Isaiah's declarations of what he spoke about God already in this chapter, and now about based on these penetrating two questions about whom you will liken God and what will the likeness your likeness be compared to him. He is going to bring down three conclusions to prove the overwhelming truth that God is above all else. And we're going to hear two of them today, and we'll save the third one for next week because we have communion. Here's the first one. Number one, let's prove that God is above all else. Number one, he is separate from idols. Verses 19 through 21. The workman melts a graven image, and the goldsmith spreads it with gold, and he casts or attaches silver chains. Isaiah now speaks with great irony as he describes how a craftsman, and I don't mean a craftsman lawnmower, I mean a craftsman who makes things, a builder, a creator, a human person that is good at doing something of his craft, and that is, in this case, making an idol, right? He is melting a graven image. He's forming it. He's put it in the fire. We know that this has got to be something that is not burnable. It's some kind of precious metal. And he's forming the image, making it just perfect. And then he's overlaying it with gold, and he attaches a chain to it. He decorates it. But some commentators think the chain, hear me out, the chain that was attached was once the idol was sold to the idolater, the person who was going to worship it, would use that chain to hang it in their home or attach it in their home so that it wouldn't fall off the wall. Now look at verse 20. He that is so impoverished that he hath no oblation chooses a tree that will not rot. He seeketh unto him a cunning workman to prepare a graven image that shall not be moved. Verse 20. Some people, Isaiah says, can't afford the idol that goes through the fire, the idol that has gold on it, and the idol that has silver attached to it. Some people are very poor. Notice the word impoverished. The person that is poor, that has no money to be able to give to the craftsman, and nothing to offer because he's so poor, guess what idol he has to make? You can see it. He says the idol that he makes is he goes out into the forest and he finds a tree. And notice the description of the tree. It's a tree that won't rot. He finds a piece of wood. He goes to a tree. He doesn't go to the dead tree that the wood is going to rot. He finds a good living tree and he takes from that tree wood because he can't afford gold. He can't afford silver. He's got to get the cheap. But he still wants an idol. So he goes and he gets this wood, and then look what he does. He takes the wood. He must have a little bit of money because he takes it to a skilled craftsman to carve out of that piece of wood what? Another idol. Mm-hmm. But this is absurd when you start to think about it in light of what Isaiah has already said in this chapter. What is the absurdity of all of this? It's that God is the one that's created these people. God's created us. It is the all-wise, infinite, powerful God who made humanity from the dust of the ground. And it is that same created humanity who is now doing what? Fashioning idols from God's creation of metal and wood. Isaiah is basically boiling this down to an absurd notion that man can create something that represents the creator who created man. Did you follow that? That man is now taking this idol, a representative of God or gods, but in reality it is God who created man who is trying to create something of God. What foolishness. What craziness. I don't know what other word to describe it. What absurd notion. And what is man going to do once he makes the idol? What's he going to do? He's going to worship it. It is man. It is man, friends. At least I'm describing myself. I don't have any power. I don't have any wisdom. I don't have any sovereignty for sure of my own. But you know what? I don't have any wisdom hardly. I mean, what little wisdom I have is from where? God. What strength been given to me is from God. What actions I can do today is because of God. Whatever accomplishments I do throughout my life is because of God. But yet, we take what we think is our power and our wisdom and our sovereignty, not that we have much, and we make an idol that's going to stand on a wall. But here's more of it. We create this idol, but the idol can't see, can't hear, can't talk, can't smell, can't touch, can't walk, and certainly has no throat, can't swallow any food. Psalm 115, 4 through 7 speaks of that. I don't know about that last part about swallowing food. I think I added that. But the idol can't even stand up or be placed in a home without the help of man. In other words, not only is the person who is making this idol, the whole notion is absurd, the idol itself is full of absurdity. I mean, to be honest, I like it when my wife responds to me when I talk to her. I like it when my wife can see me. But what's an idol? And people are worshiping these things? Can't do any of this without God's creation of man. Man is nothing. The idol's nothing without the creation of man. And then when they do create it, the idol's nothing anyway. The whole thing is pointless. The height of foolishness then, in your notes, is that man attempts to reduce God to an idol and create idols or representations of God. You know what Isaiah is doing? He's using sarcasm to ridicule man's attempts to raise himself up and put God down. But that's what the nation was doing. And friends, that's what we do. When we choose our things and make them more important than God, and we don't attribute our money and whatever's been given to us, our possessions, if we attribute it to ourselves instead of God who has given it to us. And frankly, the church is full of people who think they have done and got and received stuff because they have done it. That's idolatry. Verse 21. Isaiah goes on, "Have you not known? Have you not heard? Hath it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understand from the foundation of the earth?" The prophet now appeals to the history of Israel and he asks them several questions. He says this. He says, "Don't you know this?" Well, you say, well, what is he talking about? Don't you know what? Well, what's the context? Don't you know the absurdity of worshiping idols is what this is compared to God who has revealed it all to you and who's created you? He's saying, "Don't you know this?" And what's the answer? They knew it. He goes on and he says, "Haven't you heard? Haven't you been told by God from the beginning that this is what it is about idolatry?" And you say, "Pastor Andy, is that true?" Turn to Exodus chapter 20 real quickly. We've got to do this fast, but Exodus 20, and I won't repeat all these verses. They're in your notes. You're going to have to take time on your own. But these verses are saying the same thing basically over and over. Look at Exodus 20. In the midst of the law being given at Mount Sinai, God said, "Thou shalt not make any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down thyself to them. You will not serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God. Which we heard about in the Sunday school hour about what that means, a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children, upon the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. Friends, can an idol forgive your sin? Can an idol show mercy to you? Can an idol love you? Can an idol teach you about what's right and wrong? God says, don't make any graven image made in my likeness, because you can't contain me in an image. That's what Isaiah had just shown in chapter 40. Can God keep his promises? Yes. Can idols? No. So why are you worshiping them? That's what he was asking them. That's what he was trying to get across. But yet we're prone to wander, aren't we? Right back to it. You can look at the passages in Deuteronomy. They're just basically the same thing. Over the history of Israel, friends, remember the questions here back in Isaiah 40, verse 21? Didn't you not know about the idols? In other words, you know what God's saying? Have you seen the idols do anything for you? How'd the idols do? Let me ask you, how'd the idols do? And how did the false gods of Egypt do versus God and the plagues? You remember those plagues? How'd that work out for the gods of Egypt? Who is it that brought you out of Egypt? Who is it that brought you into the wilderness? Who is it that brought you into the land? Is it those false gods? Is it your likenesses you created to make it look like me or represent me? The nation of Israel had witnessed the inferiority and impotence of idols. They had witnessed God's hand of protection to save them from disaster. They knew God's creation. They had seen him work his redemption out of Egypt. They had seen his power in plagues. They had seen the crossing of the Red Sea. They had been given his law. They knew it was God. They knew idols were worthless, powerless, and pointless. God had given them the truth, and yet they refused it. And they were prone to wander, weren't they? Because you know what they did? They kept going back to the idols. And in Isaiah's day, the people continued to refuse God's word through the lips of the prophet. They continued to refuse his truth. But they had no excuses, because they had the knowledge of God through the law, the prophets, his word. They had a national heritage of the truth, yet they rebelled against it. Isaiah says, have you not known? Have you not heard? Hath it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth that you shouldn't be making these gods, because they're not doing anything for you? Okay, but then we fast forward to 2022, and the lessons still remain the same for us and mankind today, right? We keep worshiping. We keep following our fantasies in our minds. That's what the world does, and the church wants to dabble in it. One day, mankind's going to regret their folly, Romans chapter 1 tells us. Because only God deserves our worship. And you know what the kicker is? You used to be an idolater, whether you realized it or not. Before you came to Christ, before you came in belief, you were not only God's enemy, Paul says, you were an idolater, because the only thing you could worship was yourself. Oh, you say, I didn't have any gods in my house. I was a good person. Doesn't matter, because the only person you pleased was yourself. It was impossible to please God. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. It's impossible to worship anything else. But once you became a believer, now you were given a choice. And sadly, that old nature's still with us, and we're still prone to wander. Number two, Isaiah shows that God is separate from idols. He also says he is superior over his creation. Look at the rest of this section today. Look what he shows about God. He says, it is he that sitteth upon the circle of the earth. The inhabitants are grasshoppers. That stretches out the heavens as a curtain and spreadeth them as a tent to dwell in. I'll explain all this in just a second, but Isaiah has shown that God is exclusive above all the idols and those who make them. He's going to have more to say that, by the way, coming up in some of the later chapters. So we won't talk any more about idols right now, but we have lots more to say about the foolishness of worshiping idols to come. because Isaiah's got more to write about. So he moves, though, to the fact that Isaiah now reminds that God is not above all the, just above and separate from all the idols. He is not, you're not to make any graven image in his likeness, because that's impossible. Number two, he is superior over his creation. And he reminds the people that God is supreme and has supremacy over the earth and all of its leaders, a truth that the people of Israel already knew. They had witnessed it with Egypt. They had witnessed it with Assyria. And while some of the nation had gone into Assyria, some of them would go into Babylon, and they would go into captivity. God had promised them what? Someday my glory will return. Someday my son will reign. He is promising these things here in the book. And friends, let me tell you, in other words, the people knew it. The people had heard. They had been told the following truths. And here it is. Here's two more things that shows that God is superior over his creation. Number one, God is truly the administrator of the world. God is truly the administrator of the world. And he proves it in three sentences or clauses. Look, he says, it is he, God, that sits upon the circle of the earth. What's the circle of the earth? That's the horizon. God sits above the earth. It's a picture of God's position, of being seated on a throne and continually upholding his creation. It's one thing to say God created, right? In the beginning, God created. It's one thing. We believe God created. But it would be unimpressive if God couldn't sustain it. And you know what Isaiah is saying? God sustains it. God's sitting there in control of it. Isaiah unequivocally states that God remains in control and keeps it all under his control. But not only that, what does he compare people to? He says the inhabitants of the earth are grasshoppers. Man, that kind of sounds like something I didn't want to hear today. I think myself to be a little better than a grasshopper. How many grasshoppers or bugs have you squished lately? How many flies have you swung at lately in your house? We don't like these annoying things. Grasshoppers. And of course, you remember the story earlier in Numbers about, you remember the grasshopper and giant story? Joshua and Caleb and the spies went in the land and only two came out with a faith-filled report. The other 10 said, oh, they're too big. We're grasshoppers. They're giants. We can't surely defeat the Canaanites. And what did Joshua and Caleb say? Let's go up now. Let's go up right now. Because God is on our side. You know what? You know what the 10 spies saw? They saw themselves as grasshoppers and those people as giants. You know what Joshua and Caleb saw? They saw God and his plan and his promises and his word. That's what Isaiah is saying. Let me show you God's plan here in chapter 40. Here's God's plan. I am going to pardon their iniquity. I am going to bring my glory. And then he says, here's the promise. My word will never change. And God proves it by saying all the inhabitants of the earth are grasshoppers. Now, we are not literally grasshoppers. But when you compare yourself to God, friends, we're like grasshoppers. We're just tiny little things. Now, not insignificant ultimately. We're not insignificant. My neighbor came over this week and he said something to the effect about feeling insignificant in this grand world. And I said to my neighbor, I said, you are insignificant in that sense. We're just one person in those billions of people. And when you compare yourself to the Grand Canyon, you feel insignificant. Or to Mount Baker. But friends, let me tell you, God didn't think we were insignificant. He thought we were worth something because he sent his son to die for us. But compared to God, and his grandeur and his transcendence and above all else-ness, if we could use that term. We are grasshoppers because God is above us. Thirdly, God stretches the heavens like a curtain. The word curtain means a thin overhead veil or canopy, like a pitched tent under which people dwell. And this indicated that God had spread out and created the heavens and the skies as a canopy of protection over his people. In other words, God placed the heavens like this canopy over us, like a pitched tent. And the picture is, we're the people, we're the little people. underneath that large canopy who God is. You see what I'm saying? God is vast. God is massive. God is transcendent over it all. He's truly supreme in the heavenlies. He rules over his people. He's superior. But there's more. Look at verse 23. He is not only the administrator of the world, he is the administrator over all the rulers of the earth. So you might say, and the children of Judah would have said, well, wait a second, there seems to be some tough, rough kings around here that are taking over all the land here, and they want to defeat us. They seem that they're in control. Doesn't seem, where's God? You know what Isaiah says? It is God, verse 23, that brings the princes to what? Nothing. It is God who makes the judges of the earth as vanity. Yea, they will not be planted, they will not be sown, their stock will not take root in the earth. He's talking about the princes and the judges. He also will just blow upon them like this. A little bit of wind on them, on these judges and princes, and what will happen? They will wither, and the whirlwind will take them away like stubble. In other words, Judah, you think Babylon's going to be, you think they're really bad? You think they really have control? You think Assyria? You think whoever, the Greeks, the Romans, whatever is going to be? Of course, they didn't know about the Greeks and the Romans at this point, but coming up they would. Daniel started talking about it in Babylon. The strongest leaders in the world cannot resist the power of God, including those who rule with iron lordship. You name every single dictator who has ruled this world, and you tell me who's lasted against God. Yes, they've done their dastardly bad things. I'm not discounting those people. But I'm saying in the end, they were frail human beings. You know what? All their power, you know where all their power is right now? All those who died, you know where Hitler's power is? Gone. Mm-hmm. Gone. Do you remember Nebuchadnezzar? The very king that would destroy Jerusalem. The very king that would take down the temple of these people. What did God do to Nebuchadnezzar? You remember? He walked around like a four-footed beast because he thought his pride, he was better than God. And you want to read a prayer of worship to Almighty God from a king who had been humiliated by the king? You read in Daniel about Nebuchadnezzar and what he says about God once he realizes he's nothing. God says, I'll bring the princes down. I'll bring the judges to earth. They're nothing. They're vanity. And then the lives of the world's leaders, he says, can't even be planted, sown, and they barely can take root. They barely can take root on this earth before what happens? God blows on them like a hot east wind. They wither and they're done for. Now Isaiah concludes this, verse 25. To whom then will you liken me, or who is my equal, saith the Holy One? What's the answer? The conclusion is obvious. To whom can be likened? It's a repeat of how we started this short sermon today in verse 18. He repeats the same question. He says, whom will you liken to me? To whom am I equal? The conclusion is obvious. No one can be God's equal. Nothing can be likened to me. When man views himself in his frailty compared to the divine, eternal, powerful, glorious, holy God, nothing comes close to God. God is truly in his own class. Because he is over his creation. He rules over them all. He raises up even the rulers who think they're strong and mighty and powerful and brings them right back down. And he proves idols to be powerless. And all they are inept man-made creations. You know what Psalm 2 says? The Holy One and his Messiah are truly the soul beings of the universe that are worthy of our worship, love, and devotion. It is truly God who will judge the wicked and reward the righteous. Let me sing the song. No, I'm not going to sing it. Let me repeat the words again now after this sermon. Oh, to grace, how great a debtor. Daily I'm constrained to be. Let thy goodness, like a fetter, bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, O take and seal it for thy courts above. Above all else. Name above all names. Have we seen that in this chapter? God above all gods. Creator above all creation. That's what we're seeing here. So let me ask you again. Is there anything in your heart that is in the place of God? Does God have everything in your life? Is there something in your life that you know that is really an idol? That's really taking the place of God? Do you adore God all the time or just some of the time? Is God's name to you above all else? Truly is God above all else. Let's close.